we figure out.
What? Wait, wait, wait. So today we are at chapter 8, The Supreme Will, in the new edition on page 208, paragraph 1. First, a little meditation, as usual, if you agree, I think. And I have a new app. Can we test this app?
Yeah.
Let me see if it works.
No, it.
You don't hear it?
No, it comes and goes.
Oh, then we have the same problem as usual. Then let me see if this works better.
It's better, but it dies out, but it's better.
This is more Buddhist stuff.
Well, yours, Jeffrey Chen, is not so great either. So
okay.
It doesn't do the whole thing. So the second one, Marco, I think would be just lovely.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, wait. Let me begin in a decent way. So I think this was the second one. No.
Oh, it was a deeper one.
Yeah. It was not this one. I don't know. It doesn't work. This one.
That's better.
Okay, it's enough. I'm sorry, I will have to make more technical tests for the next time. Because
maybe we'll just stick with Jeffrey Jan's bell because that never hurt.
Yeah. Let me try for the next time too, because it's a new app. I never used this app, so I'm not acquainted with it. And when the screen turns off, it stops counting. That's obviously a setting that has to be.
What's the name of the app, Marco?
Inside something.
And is it on Android or?
Yeah, Android. Yeah.
Yeah, mine's on iPad.
Mm. I never used it. This was the first time, but it worked well for the first 3 seconds, and then I said, "It's okay, fine."
It does something to the signal, the Zoom. So,
yeah, I think it's also the algorithm of Zoom because it is trimmed for the human voice, so it cuts out probably also the sounds that are not human. So, yeah, okay. So, who was first? I think John Robert.
Chapter 8, The Supreme Will. In the light of this progressive manifestation of the Spirit, first apparently bound in ignorance, then free in the power and wisdom of the infinite, we can better understand the great and crowning injunction of the Gita to the Karma Yogin. Abandoning all dharmas, all principles, and laws and rules of conduct, take refuge in me alone. All standards and rules are temporary constructions founded upon the needs of the ego in its transition from matter to spirit. These makeshifts have a relative imperativeness so long as we rest satisfied in the stages of transition, content with the physical and vital life, attached to the mental movement, or even fixed in the ranges of the mental plane that are touched by the spiritual lusters. But beyond is the unwalled wideness of a supramental infinite consciousness, and there all temporary structures cease. It is not possible to enter utterly into the spiritual truth of the eternal and infinite if we have not the faith and courage to trust ourselves into the hands of the Lord of all things and the friend of all creatures, and leave utterly behind us our mental limits and measures. At one moment, we must plunge without hesitation, reserve, fear, or scruple into the ocean of the free, the infinite, the absolute. After the law, liberty. After the personal, after the general, after the universal standards, there is something greater, the impersonal plasticity, the divine freedom, the transcendent force and the supernal impulse. After the straight path of the ascent, the wide plateaus on the summit.
There are three stages of the ascent. At the bottom, the bodily life enslaved to the pressure of necessity and desire. In the middle, the mental, higher, emotional and psychic rule that feels after greater interests, aspirations, experiences. At the summits, first a deeper psychic and spiritual state, and then a supramental eternal consciousness in which all our aspirations and seekings discover their own intimate significance. the bodily life first, desire and need, and then the practical good of the individual and the society are the governing consideration, the dominant force. In the mental life, ideas and ideals rule. In the mental life, ideas and ideals rule, ideas that are half-lights wearing the garb of truth, ideals formed by the mind as a result of a growing but still imperfect intuition and experience. Whenever the mental life prevails and the bodily diminishes its brute insistence, man, the mental being, feels pushed by the urge of mental nature to mold in the sense of the idea or the ideal the life of the individual, and in the end, even the vaguer, more complex life of the society is forced to undergo this subtle process. In spiritual life, or even a higher power than mind has manifested and taken possession of the nature. In the spiritual life, or when a higher power than mind has manifested and taken possession of the nature, these limited motive forces recede, dwindle, tend to disappear. The spiritual or supramental self, the divine being, the supreme and immanent reality, must be alone the Lord within us and shape freely our final development according to the highest, widest, most integral expression possible of the law of our nature. In the end, that nature acts in the perfect truth and its spontaneous freedom, for it obeys only the luminous power of the eternal. The individual has nothing further to gain, no desire to fulfill. He has become a portion of the impersonality or the universal personality of the eternal. No other object than the manifestation and play of the divine spirit in life and the maintenance and conduct of the world in its march towards the divine goal can move him to action. Mental ideas, opinions, constructions are his no more, for his mind has fallen into silence. It is only a channel for the light and truth of the divine knowledge. Ideas are too narrow for the vastness of his spirit. It is the ocean of the infinite that flows through him and moves him forever.
Do we need a moment in between here? Okay. Whoever sincerely enters the path of works must leave behind him the stage in which need and desire are the first law of our acts. For whatever desires still trouble his being, he must, if he accepts the high aim of yoga, put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. The supreme power will deal with them for the good of the sadhaka and for the good of all. In effect, we find that once this surrender is done, always provided the rejection is sincere, egoistic indulgence of desire may for some time recur under the continued impulse of past nature, but only in order to exhaust its acquired momentum and to teach the embodied being in his most unteachable part, his nervous, vital, emotional nature, by the reactions of desire, by its grief and unrest bitterly contrasted with calm periods of the higher peace or marvelous movements of divine Ananda, that egoistic desire is not a law for the soul that seeks liberation or aspires to its own original God nature. Afterwards, the element of desire in those impulsions will be thrown away or persistently eliminated by a constant denying and transforming pressure. Only the pure force of action in them, pravritti, justified by an equal delight in all work and result that is inspired or imposed from above, will be preserved in the happy harmony of a final perfection. To act, to enjoy, is the normal law and right of the nervous being. But to choose by personal desire its action and enjoyment is only its ignorant will, not its right. Alone the supreme and universal will must choose. Action must change into a dynamic movement of that will. Enjoyment must be replaced by the play of a pure spiritual ananda. All personal will is either a temporary delegation from on high or a usurpation by the ignorant asura.
I don't mind reading this, but I don't exactly go along with it. So I'm not quite sure what that does. Andrea and I had a discussion yesterday about the role of trauma in relation to Aurobindo's writing. And I'm still struggling with that. I can't decide when he says, like in the beginning of this one, this section, put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. Can't decide whether that's supposed to apply to the traumatic experiences that are part of the real world. It seems a bit too simple to me to work properly. So.
What I do find interesting in that particular sentence, what struck me that looks like contradiction within itself, to put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. So the away has a feeling of away from us, but then we give it to that within us. That helps to me.
Okay. The social law, that second term of our progress, is a means to which the ego is subjected in order that it may learn discipline by subordination to a wider collective ego. This law may be quite empty of any moral content, and may express only the needs or the practical good of the society as each society conceives it. Or it may express those needs and that good, but modified and colored and supplemented by a higher moral or ideal law. It is binding on the developing, but not yet perfectly developed individual in the shape of social duty, family obligation, communal or national demand, so long it is not in conflict with his growing sense of the higher right. But the sadhaka of the karma yoga will abandon this also to the Lord of Works. After he has made this surrender, his social impulses and judgments will, like his desires, only be used for their exhaustion or, it may be, so far as they are still necessary for a time to enable him to identify his lower mental nature with mankind in general, or with any grouping of mankind in its works and hopes and aspirations. But after that brief time is over, they will be withdrawn and a divine government will alone abide. He will be identified with the divine and with others only through the divine consciousness and not through the mental nature.
For even after he is free, the sadhaka will be in the world, and to be in the world is to remain in works. But to remain in works without desire is to act for the good of the world in general, or for the kind, or the race, or for some other new for some new creation to be evolved on the earth, or some work imposed by the divine will within him. I think I'm going to read that sentence again. But to remain in works without desire is to act for the good of the world in general, or for the kind, or the race, or for some new creation to be evolved on the earth, or some work imposed by the divine will within him. And this must be done either in the framework provided by the environment or the grouping in which he is born or placed, or else in one which is chosen or created for him by a divine direction. Therefore, in our perfection, there must be nothing left in the mental being which conflicts with or prevents our sympathy and free self-identification with the kind, the group, or whatever collective expression of the divine he is meant to lead, help, or serve. But in the end, it must become a free self-identification through identity with the divine, and not a mental bond or moral tie of union or a vital association dominated by any kind of personal, social, national, communal, or creedal egoism. If any social law is obeyed, it will not be from physical necessity or from the sense of personal or general interest or for expediency or because of the pressure of the environment or from any sense of duty, but solely for the sake of the Lord of works and because it is felt or known to be the divine will, and that the social law or rule or relation as it stands can still be kept as a figure of the inner life, and the minds of men must not be disturbed by its infringement. If, on the other hand, the social law, rule, or relation is disregarded, that too will not be for the indulgence of desire, personal will, or personal opinion, but because a greater rule is felt that expresses the law of the Spirit, or because it is known that there must be in the march of the divine all will a movement towards the changing, exceeding, or abolition of existing laws and forms for the sake of a freer, larger life necessary to the world's progress.
There is still left the moral law, or the ideal, and these even too many who think themselves free appear forever sacred and intangible. So I read it again. There is still left the moral law, or the ideal, and these even too many who think themselves free appear forever sacred and intangible. But the sadhaka, his gates turned always to the hates, will abandon them to him whom all ideals seek imperfectly and fragmentarily to express. All moral qualities are only a poor and rigid travesty of the spontaneous and illimitable perfection. The bondage to sin and evil passes away with the passing of nervous desire. For it belongs to the quality of vital passion, impulsion, or drive of propensity in us, rajoguna, and is extinguished with the transformation of that mode of nature. But neither must the aspirant remain subject to the gilded or golden chain of a conventional or habitual or a mentally ordered or even a high or clear sattvic virtue. That will be replaced by something profounder and more essential than the minor inadequate thing that men call virtue. Virtue. The original sense of the word was manhood, and this is a much larger and deeper thing than the moral mind and its structures. The culmination of karma yoga is a yet higher and deeper state that may perhaps be called soulhood. For the soul is greater than the man, a free soulhood, spontaneously welling out in works of supreme truth and love, will replace human virtue. But this supreme truth cannot be forced to inhabit the petty edifices of the practical reason, or even confined in the more dignified constructions of the larger ideative reason that imposes its representations as if they were pure truths on the limited human intelligence. This supreme love will not necessarily be consistent, much less will it be synonymous with the partial and feeble, ignorant and emotion-ridden movements of human attraction, sympathy and pity. The petty law cannot bind the vaster movement. The mind's partial attainment cannot dictate its terms to the soul's supreme fulfillment.
At first, the higher love and truth will fulfill its movement in the sadhaka according to the essential law or way of his own nature. For that is the special aspect of the divine nature, the particular power of the supreme shakti, out of which his soul has emerged into the play. Not limited indeed by the forms of this law or way, for the soul is infinite. But still, its stuff of nature bears that stamp, evolved fluently along those lines, or turns around the spiral curves of that dominating influence. He will manifest the divine truth movement according to the temperament of the sage, or the lion-like fighter, or the lover and enjoyer, or the worker and servant, or in any combination of essential attributes, gunas, that may constitute the form given to his being by its own inner urge. It is this self-nature playing freely in his acts which men will see in him, and not a conduct cut, chalked out, artificially regulated by any lesser rule or by any law from outside.
But there is a yet higher attainment. There is an infinity, anantya, in which even this last limitation is exceeded, because the nature is utterly fulfilled and its boundaries vanish. There the soul lives without any boundaries, for it uses all forms and molds according to the divine will in it. But it is not restrained, it is not tied down, it is not imprisoned in any power or form that it uses. This is the summit of the path of works, and this the utter liberty of the soul in its actions. In reality, it has there no actions, for all its activities are a rhythm of the supreme and sovereignly proceed from that alone, like a spontaneous music out of the infinite.
So we stop there.
Yeah. I really like this segment where he describes our individual nature as part of being an instrument. Most of the time that doesn't seem to come into the text, and I find that rather relieving. And I can relate to that. You know, the next step is like beyond me, but this one I can relate to.
I always find that when he waxes poetic, I'm much more in tune with what he's saying. Possibly that's why we like Savitri so much.
Yes, that may bypass the mental self a little bit, right?
There, I think this. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Marco.
Okay, thank you. No, I was just thinking to go back to the paragraph 3. And was if you were wanting to comment on Andrea, it's better that you conclude the thought, because I'm just changing subject.
Go ahead and change.
Okay. No, but because what gives me a bit to think about is it seems to me that he does not align himself with, at least with modern Western psychology, no? Because he sees things a bit differently here when he says egoistic indulgence of desire, this nervous vital elements of desire, impulsions, should be thrown away or persistently eliminated by a constant denying and transforming pressure. It's hard, because it's nice to indulge in one's own desires. And we were told that we should not repress desires, aren't we? So one might ask if it is reconcilable or it's not. And how far, one should take this seriously, because but to choose by personal desire and its action and enjoyment is only its ignorant will. Yeah. So it's, I suppose, of the ego. I don't remember now here. And action must change into a dynamic movement of that will. Will with a capital W, which is compared to the lowercase w, which is our will, not the divine will. So I think that, I suppose that also a lot of people have a difficulty to read Sri Aurobindo, because when they come through these paragraphs, they say, no, it's not true. They feel it, or they don't agree. And they say, that's not how things should happen in a sadhana or in a psychological transformation or whatever you might call it. So just a comment, or it's not even a question. Yeah, it's in a certain sense, it's a question. Is this reconcilable with modern Western psychology, or is there a clear distinction? And Sri Aurobindo says, no, I don't agree. And Western psychology says, no, I don't agree with Sri Aurobindo. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm just inventing stuff as I go, but I do tend to. So when Andrea and I were reading in the Vedas yesterday, we came across this list of properties, seven properties, and it was my body, mind. Anyway, I can't remember the first three. Spirit, maybe. Right. And then anyway, there was. You need to unmute yourself, Andrea.
Yeah, and then bliss came first, bliss, and then will, and then being. So
essential being was at the top, but being. Will was underneath it. Then yes. Further down was bliss.
Yes.
And eventually you got down into the mind-body stuff. So will seems to be near the top, as it were, which kind of goes with the sort of Agni will thing. So in the Vedas, right? So the Agni is one of the stronger aspects of that we're talking about, and Agni is will. And so I tend to think of these things as being maybe not necessarily applying to, you know, depending on where one is in one's progress in these things, it's not necessarily one where one is at when one is in the early stages of moving through these things. It's more talking about things that happen at the later stages, as you know, if you can clear up some of this early stuff, then you can move into spaces where you could do something like this. But yeah. I don't think you can do it if you're early on in the process, you know. So that's the way to sort of read this.
And psychological progress is included, of course, in spiritual progress, but it's limited, right? It doesn't go to surrender to the divine will. That's not part of Western psychology.
Ah, no, for sure not.
So we're talking about a whole other realm, a whole other approach.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is part of your AA stuff, right? So, I mean, it may not be part of standard Western psychology, but it is part of some Western psychological practices.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's where recovery actually, in my mind, is a step ahead of regular psychology, because it really sees the flaw in the individual will, because the will has been what's the word, polluted by addiction. Once addiction is in the mind, in the physical mind, actually, it will run the show whether you like it or not, unless you transcend the mind. So the transcendence
actually back to the trauma issue, because of course recovery is about managing trauma as well.
So. Yeah, that's all part of the grist for the mill, right?
The trauma thing, I think it's also, isn't it also related to subconscious? So here it is of course also connected with this desires and will of the individual will and so on, but it's a realm which acts at the subconscious level, and of which we are only partially aware.
But as Andrea pointed out when we were talking about this yesterday, it's not just the subconscious level. It's also body.
Body and subconscious, yes. Yes.
So
it's not only vital. It's not only emotional of which we are conscious, but it is also an emotional part and a physical part of which we are not really conscious. We are only conscious of the tip of the iceberg, so to speak.
Yeah.
And Western psychology, I think, has accepted this long ago now. All this idea of subconscious. And so. But it does, as far as I understand it, it does not accept really this idea of the soul. I don't know if you know Elizabeth Teklinski. She wrote an entire dissertation, PhD thesis, about the fact that this idea of the psychic being that Sri Aurobindo has is not contained in whatever kind of psychology, also in those psychologies which are open to a spiritual understanding of life. But I don't know.
Yeah, so Jung uses the word soul, but he doesn't quite mean what we mean in the spiritual sphere. He uses as a kind of a shorthand to talk about the psychic being in a sort of more general psychological way, rather than the sort of larger spiritual realm.
And it has also not, as I understand it, it is not accepted the evolutionary dimension. The soul, yes, if there is a soul, it's just there. It's something static there. But it's in Sri Aurobindo, the soul has also this idea that it's something that progresses in the evolution of life and experiences in the body and in life. Yeah. And this makes part of the psychology of an integral yoga. Yeah, except, of course, integral psychology of those people who have founded their psychology on the Sri Aurobindo writings. I think that it's not. But, well, this was not really my point, but in any case, it doesn't matter. But quick parenthesis. When you, Jeffrey, were distinguishing between the will and then bliss, being, and so on. But that will is a will with capital W.
Yes. Yeah. It's capital W. Yeah.
Whereas here, when he says egoistic indulgence of desire and so on, it's a lowercase will that desires.
Right.
And we have...
Yeah.
And that's a hard work to do. Shift from one will to another.
Nobody said any of this was easy. I don't think.
Exactly.
Sri Aurobindo says this is easy work.
No.
In fact, it's considered maybe the hardest path of all.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
When we speak of evolution, this being an evolutionary path and the evolution of the soul and so on, we could also apply that to Western psychology, because you have a lot of movements in Western psychology and have for 30 or 40 years at least, into transpersonal psychology, where it is moving in the direction of, you might call it, higher consciousness or something like that. And it may not be specifically defined like Sri Aurobindo defines in his cosmology, but it seems like to me that if you just talk about experiences, you might get closer to what he's talking about here in the later stages of yoga than you would in, you know, Freudian or some of the, you know, behaviorism or something like that. So psychology is, I think it's also evolving. Western psychology is also evolving.
But you, John Robert, were going to say something else. If I remember well, you wanted to say something else.
It's long gone, Marco.
I'm sorry if I have wiped out your memory, because it was very long and I know what it means. And maybe it was not so tremendously urgent then.
Yeah, we don't know if there's even any reason to be sorry, since we don't know what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
It could have been something completely trivial. Shall we go on?
Where are we and who's next?
It's my reading.
Total surrender, and I think it's John Robert.
Yeah. The total surrender, then, of all our actions to a supreme and universal will, an unconditioned and standardless surrender of all works to the government of something eternal within us, which will replace the ordinary working of the ego nature, is the way and end of Karma Yoga. But what is this divine supreme will, and how can it be recognized by our deluded instruments and our blind, prisoned intelligence?
And Marco will provide us with the answer.
Yes, of course. It's written here. You have just continued to read. In fact, ordinarily, we conceive of ourselves as a separate I in the universe that governs a separate body and mental and moral nature, chooses in full liberty its own self-determined actions, and is independent and therefore sole master of its works and responsible. It is not easy for the ordinary mind, the mind that has not thought nor looked deeply into its own constitution and constituents. It is difficult even for minds that have thought but have no spiritual vision and experience to imagine how there can be anything else in us truer, deeper, and more powerful than this apparent I and its empire. But the very first step towards self-knowledge, as towards the true knowledge of phenomena, is to get behind the apparent truths of things and find the real but masked, essential and dynamic truths which their appearances cover.
This ego or I is not a lasting truth, much less our essential part. It is only a formation of nature, a mental form of thought centralization in the perceiving and discriminating mind, a vital form of the centralization of feeling and sensation in our parts of life, a form of physical conscious reception centralizing substance and function of substance in our bodies. All that we internally are is not ego, but consciousness, soul, or spirit. All that we externally and superficially are and do is not ego, but nature. An executive cosmic force shapes us and dictates through our temperament and environment and mentality so shaped, through our individualized formulation of the cosmic energy, our actions and their results. Truly, we do not think, will, or act, but thought occurs in us. Will occurs in us. Impulse and act occur in us. Our ego sense gathers around itself, refers to itself all this flow of natural activities. It is cosmic force. It is nature that forms the thought, imposes the will, imparts the impulse. Our body, mind, and ego are a wave of that sea of force in action and do not govern it, but by it are governed and directed. The sadhaka in his progress towards truth and self-knowledge must come to a point where the soul opens its eyes of vision and recognizes this truth of ego and his truth and this truth of works. He gives up the idea of a mental, vital, physical I that acts or governs action. He recognizes that prakriti, force of cosmic nature, following her fixed modes, is in him and in all things and creatures, and is in him and in all things and creatures, the one and only worker.
What has fixed the modes of nature? Or who has originated and governs the movements of force? There is a consciousness or a conscient. Behind that is the Lord, witness, knower, enjoyer, upholder, and source of sanction for her works. This consciousness is soul or purusha. Prakriti shapes the action in us. Purusha in her or behind her witnesses, assents, bears, and upholds it. Prakriti forms the thought in our minds. Purusha in her or behind her knows the thought and the truth in it. Prakriti determines the result of the action. Purusha in her or behind her enjoys and suffers the consequence. Prakriti forms mind and body, labors over them, develops them. Purusha upholds the formation and evolution and sanctions each step of her works. Prakriti applies the will force which works in things and men. Purusha sets that will force to work by his vision of that which should be done. This Purusha is not the surface ego, but a silent self, a source of power, an originator and receiver of knowledge behind the ego. Our mental eye is only a false reflection of this self, this power, this knowledge. This Purusha, or supporting consciousness, is therefore the cause, recipient, and support of all nature's works. But he is not himself the doer. Prakriti, nature force, in front, and Shakti, conscious force, soul force, behind her. For these two are the inner and outer faces of the Universal Mother, account for all that is done in the universe. The Universal Mother, Prakriti Shakti, is the one and only worker. There's a lot in that paragraph.
Did you want to stop here, Jeffrey?
No, I'm good.
Purusha Prakriti, consciousness, force, soul supporting nature. For the two, even in their separation, are one and inseparable, are at once a universal and a transcendent power. But there is something in the individual too, which is not the mental ego, something that is one in essence with this greater reality. It is a pure reflection or portion of the one Purusha. It is the soul person, or the embodied being, the individual self, Jivatman. It is the self that seems to limit its power and knowledge so as to support an individual play of transcendent and universal nature. In deepest reality, the infinitely one is also infinitely multiple. We are not only a reflection or portion of that, but we are that. Our spiritual individuality, unlike our ego, does not preclude our universality and transcendence. But at present, the soul or self in us, intent on individualization in nature, allows itself to be confused with the idea of the ego. It has to get rid of this ignorance. It has to know itself as a reflection or portion or being of the supreme and universal self, and solely a center of its consciousness in the world action. But this Jiva Purusha too is not the doer of works any more than the ego or the supporting consciousness of the witness and knower. Again and always, it is the transcendent and universal Shakti who is the sole doer. But behind her is the one supreme who manifests through her as the dual power, Purusha Prakriti, Ishwara Shakti. The supreme becomes dynamic as the Shakti, and it is by her the sole originator and master of works in the universe.
Well, I need to step out for a bit.
Yeah. I think there is a lot of stuff here, at least from a philosophical point of view. Because then I think the most important thing is this distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. As I intended, let me see if you resonate with this or not. I used to say, we have thoughts, because in our modern understanding, philosophical understanding, there is this idea that mind and consciousness are the same thing. But I don't think that one needs to become an Aurobindonian to see that this is a conflation that does not, is incorrect, I think, because just from our experience, mind is one thing, consciousness is something else. And here I usually say there's a distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. If I step back, I can see many thoughts. I'm aware of many thoughts coming and going. But there is a witness that sees or becomes aware of these thoughts and that come and go. But the witness does not come and go. It's there. And it's always the same witness, whereas the thoughts are always different. Could we say that the witness is Purusha and these thoughts coming and going are part of Prakriti, the mental Prakriti?
I don't think we want to define the Purusha as the witness. I think witnessing is one of the powers of the Purusha.
Yeah.
Sri Aurobindo says that this Purusha has other powers. Or other functions, sanctioning, for example.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it, you know, when you're in the witness consciousness, you could say that's what one of, that could be identified with a stage of the Purusha.
But at least it makes a distinction between mind and consciousness, because they're not the same thing, mind and consciousness.
Oh, yeah, it may. I mean, you can use it that way, I guess. Although you don't want to say consciousness is the witness. You want, because consciousness is more than witness.
Yeah,
it is that. Okay. It is more than that.
This is a good point. Yes. Yeah.
So I remember how last time when we read the footnote on the Ishvara Shakti, that was very helpful to me. I wonder if you could read that.
Okay. Ishvara Shakti is not quite the same as Purusha Prakriti. The Purusha and Prakriti are separate powers, but Ishvara and Shakti contain each other. Ishvara is Purusha who contains Prakriti and rules by the power of Shakti within him. Shakti is Prakriti ensouled by Purusha and acts by the will of the Ishvara, which is her own will and whose presence in her movement she carries always with her. The Purusha Prakriti realization is of the first utility to the seeker on the way of works, for it is the separation of the conscient being and the energy and the subjection of the being to the mechanism of the energy that are the efficient cause of our ignorance and imperfection. By this realization, the being can liberate himself from the mechanical action of the nature and become free and arrive at first spiritual control of the nature. Ishvara Shakti stands behind the relation of Purusha Prakriti and its ignorant action and turns it to an evolutionary purpose. This Ishvara Shakti realization can bring participation in a higher dynamism and divine working and a total unity and harmony of the being in a spiritual nature. This is one of the most difficult parts that I read so far, because I didn't get it the last time and I don't get it, still don't get it, especially the first part where he says Ishvara is Purushak who contains Prakriti and rules by the power of Sushakti within him. Shakti is Prakriti ensouled by Purusha and acts by the will of the Ishvara, which is her own will and whose presence in the movement she carries always with her. So if someone can make a diagram, perhaps could be useful. So
it seems that the Ishvara Shakti is the two in one.
Yeah.
Okay. Is completely the two in one. So you cannot separate them. The one has the other and the other has the first one. And then comes in the low, in the manifestation, you get Purusha Prakriti, where these same forces have come down on a more material plane, I suppose, and work out there in a more ignorant way, like the way nature just moves along and souls move along, and they are not quite necessarily aware of each other or themselves. So it seems like the Ishvara Shakti in the Purusha Prakriti is like the lower manifestation of that.
Yeah.
That's how I understand this.
Like Satchitananda, where we have also something very similar. This is Triun and Triun. It's one and three at the same time. So, and here it's Biyun. It's two and one at the same time. Something like that.
I don't want to mix things up, which I'm probably going to do, but we were reading yesterday Surya Savitri in The Secret of the Veda. And there we talk about Surya as the creator, the increaser, and those are different aspects of Surya Savitri, or Surya. And I kind of think this stuff in terms of that stuff. I don't know whether that's appropriate, but I do.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's all grounded in the Vedas. This part of the reading suggests, I mean, the Purusha is a Vedic idea, you know, these are Vedic ideas. So I think so. You know, you don't always see the Vedas directly in Sri Aurobindo's writings, but here you do.
Yeah, he uses also the same terminology or similar terminology. Yeah, Ishvara Shakti, Purusha Prakriti. I think all Vedic Sanskrit words. But I just want to. Ishvara is Purusha who contains Prakriti, and Shakti is Prakriti ensouled by Purusha. Good luck. Yeah, thank you. Maybe with time passing by, it will mean something more. Yeah, but this is something that we should not try to understand mentally with a picture or a diagram or something like that. It's something which goes much more in the intuitive realm. It's only there that we can probably get it.
Yeah, I was thinking something like that, Marco.
Yeah.
That these, I mean, Sri Aurobindo is using mental language, because that's all we have. Mm-hmm. And he's pointing something that's beyond that, pointing to experience.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Sometimes this is helpful for us where we are, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
There's a short passage on page 214 that I really like because it points to experience. He says, right in the middle of page 214, he says, "Truly we do not think, will, or act, but thought occurs in us. Will occurs in us. Impulse and act occur in us. Our ego sense gathers around itself, refers to itself, all this flow of natural activities." And I think the recognition of thought occurring in us is really common in the arts. For example, in writers who will say, "This came to me." That's when something comes to you, it means you didn't do it, you are a receiver of it. And that's what he's talking about here in these sentences. And I think we use that language just in a lot of times in ordinary parlance, where we say, wow, something just came to me. And the ego grabs it and says, I just thought that. I just thought up a great idea. But that's not really what happened. Something came. And where did it come from? Well, we don't notice that. And we don't pay attention to that because we're really interested in the thing that came. But it's a regular occurrence that things come to us, including impulses, you know, or things maybe we'd rather not have, or great insights that we love to have. They come. It's like we're kind of going along in our, you know, obscure daily muddle, and then something pops in. Or maybe we're concentrating and trying to figure some problem out or trying to move forward with some project. We concentrate. And actually, Sri Aurobindo said when he was doing his writing, like for example, Savitri or some of his poetry, he said if something didn't sound right, what would he do? He would just get quiet and concentrate. And then it would come. Same thing. So that those two lines there, or three lines there, I think are something that can point probably all of us to experience in terms of what Sri Aurobindo is talking about. Not maybe a really high level, but it could be.
Yeah, I do agree with you, John Robert. I do think there is a kind of there's a self-delusion that the cognitive system has where it thinks it's in control and it's not. It deludes itself into thinking it's in control. And so, in a sense, all conscious experience exists of these things popping into our minds because they're coming from other parts of the being that aren't under direct conscious control. So they will always feel like they're popping in from somewhere else. But, you know, that doesn't mean to say it can't be sitting inside a larger bath as well, right? So the sort of divine or the is kind of like the larger bath within which the smaller bath of consciousness is, or whatever, it's also sitting, you know? So, and the same text that you read, if you skip down two lines, our body, mind, and ego are a wave of that sea of force in action and do not govern it, but by it are governed and directed. That is the experience of writing. So.
Yeah, I think he's also even more radical than that, because somewhere else, I think we have already read this somewhere at the beginning it was, or and you find it also elsewhere where he says that what not only these intuitive flashes, but also the more ordinary mental activity comes not from us, but is something that we receive from the outside, that thoughts coming and going from the environment. He speaks also of an environmental consciousness one can become aware in a certain state and feel like these thoughts come from the outside. So they are not at all my ideas. It's something that does not really exist, something like that.
There's a wonderful canto in Savitri. See if I can remember the name of it. It's Nirvana and the Discovery of the All-Negating Absolute, I think it is. It's in Savitri's yoga. And it's after she's realized her soul, she's realized the psychic being. And then she goes through this period where the inner voice tells her to pay attention to what's going on. And so she goes inside and stands above her mind and just watches in silence. And she sees what you're talking about, Marco, the, the influences coming from within and from without and from way far away and getting closer and closer and closer, and only to discover that the port, so he's talking, he uses the image of a ship coming, like a sailing ship coming to port. The port is closed. So it gets to the port and it just dissolves. So she winds up after going through this experience and just being in silence, and even herself is barely an experience.
Yeah, nice image. My image was here when I read these lines, that of a tornado, you know, or a big volcano, this swirling, this spiral of air, water, and clouds is what we are, an amalgam of forces, and we identify in it. No, that's not what we are. We are a soul, a psychic being, but identify in this body of cosmic form, forces. Yeah? And thoughts make part of this tornado in which we identify. Hopefully not. In fact, we can be destructive as tornadoes as well. In fact, that's not, the analogy fits on all levels, maybe, because it can be quite destructive indeed. Yeah. So we are nothing. We don't exist. We are just a play of cosmic forces. That's all. What the materialist was right. We are just a bunch of neurons, a marvel electrical fire in our heads. Said something like that. Should have been better. Yeah.
And yet okay. We are the manifestation of that.
Yeah.
The first right of a human being is to being consistent. We can be both.
Yeah, but he said that he said somewhere which is, we say, inconsistent, that something in us is naturally inconsistent in us, and it couldn't care less about the human consistencies. Here he uses it somewhere. Ah, yeah. This supreme love will not necessarily be consistent. We are even that we cannot attach, not even at that. Yeah. So the Buddhists were right, perhaps. It's all empty.
Yeah. So we are now at the same place where we ended last time, and it seems our time is quite up.
Yep.
So maybe next time we will just start at this coming paragraph, if this is the truth of work.
Okay.
And then read the last part maybe twice. Anyway, it's been a rich experience.
Yeah, I really like this chapter. It's wonderful.
Mm. Yeah, because it does also give some practical advice that something in us not necessarily likes to hear, but it tells something about what to do for the next 2 weeks. We have homework to do. Yeah, perhaps it's better that Jeffrey uses a bell for them. I will specialize my app for the next time, because otherwise it becomes a mess. Do you agree, Jeffrey? Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks everybody. Good to see you.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Good luck with your situation, John Robert. We'll be thinking about it.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.